You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store.
I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation cure master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
We're back.
We're back.
Testing, testing.
Testing, testing.
Are we back?
Jack, can you hear me?
All these years in, Patrick, still can't get the levels right there.
Nat, what? Was that Nat?
Jack, am I coming in on the mic?
It is Sunday, so that means it's the main course. We're broadcasting out of Roberta's Restaurant, 261 Moore Street. They're fresh off of probably the most positive restaurant review in the history of the Times.
Amazing review.
I'm not exaggerating.
Oh, it was an amazing review. And
they called it one of the most extraordinary restaurants in the United States.
Yes, and selfishly, Hurricane Irene disrupted our direct talking about it.
It was so funny. They got 2 stars on the same day that there was an earthquake.
Yes.
And then there was a hurricane like 4 days later. So
that could be good or bad. So we don't know.
Very, very big. We have a great show today, and we'll mention all our guests. But you, sir, are soon going to be launching a show on the Heritage Radio Network, your own show.
Wow. I thought we were going to talk about this at the end. But for everyone that is listening in, who's following my Facebook and Twitter feed all week.
I feel like an eagle that just like pushed a little baby out of the nest. And crashed, but you survived, and now you're going.
I'd like to thank 3 people. One is Patrick Martins. Number 2, Jack Inslee. Number 3, Chad Turnbull, who is going to sponsor the show with his company, Savorian Wines. And they had a big powwow this week. And everyone, you know, it was a lot of big egos in the room. It was almost like the G3 summit. But everybody kind of like
it was
got
like
together.
The big four. Churchill, Roosevelt,
or those
Stalin.
Those are the big three. And the show is going to be called The Morning After, even though it happens in the afternoon on Sunday. We haven't really spoke about a time yet or anything like that, but it's going to be Sunday afternoon. But I don't know about you, but I wake up in the afternoon on Sunday, so technically the afternoon is my morning.
I still think if it's afternoon, legally, you have to change the name of the show. It's misleading.
It is very misleading.
It's
it
in
is
the
very
afternoon.
It is very misleading. But thank you, everybody. We'll talk more about it, you know, later on in next week's show. But thank you for mentioning that. Also, I wanted to mention one thing because we're about to get into our first guest, David Deal from 205th. But does anyone, Patrick, because you're kind of in those little weird circles? Do you
Thanks.
Know geocaching? Have you ever done this before?
What's that?
Geocaching. GEOCACHE, geocaching. Mm-hmm. There are little hidden treasures around the entire world that you could find through a Facebook app called geocaching.com. They're not giving me any money or anything.
It doesn't sound like it.
And you find a specific area, and they give you clues, and then you find these little things. You write your name on it, and you can go. It's the strangest thing. Is anyone, Dave, anyone in the studio here? I feel like the weirdest person now. But I did it like 2 weeks ago with my
Jack,
friend.
Jack, run the theme song again.
But I just wanted to talk about it. It was kind of an interesting experience.
Okay, it's like the rush of the Easter egg hunt or something like
it's
that?
It's the same idea, but it's crazy because my buddy was like, hey, listen, you know there's a treasure 2 blocks from here. I'm like, we're in the middle of Park Slope. What do you mean? He's like, there's something hidden two blocks from here. So we walk there, and then we're in the middle on Butler and 3rd Avenue in Park Slope, which isn't like the best place to stand around. 2 white guys, like, you know, either we're buying drugs or something. And then we like kind of looking around, and like we find this like little small thing. We open it up and there's like a thin paper. It almost looks like the thing from the Da Vinci Code. We write our name on it. We put it back in, and then you kind of like there's this entire subculture of thing going on that no one knows about.
I'm still like, old school. I put a little message in a balloon. I launch it out my window and I ask the person to respond and tell me about what life is like in their part of the world. 100%, I'm old school.
100%.
That's why I was late today, by the way.
I figured that. I sent you the pigeon this morning. It didn't come back. It didn't have any response.
Well, the pigeons are very... I was just talking about pigeon culture. Very interesting. Pigeons, actually, communication as a communication tool is one of the big reasons why the Rothschild family
control the world's money. Ooh.
Well, no, because they would hear things just a few hours before through pigeons and then go. And, for instance, if they realized that 10 ships went down with cotton, they would buy up all the cotton. There would be a short... Just simple thing, the pigeon.
That's a similar idea to something I heard about these day traders, that they set their servers up closer to Wall Street because they get the information a half a second faster than everybody else.
Well, anyway, we're going to stop talking about fast things and start talking about slow things. Ooh. You brought on a great show. Let me just mention the whole show. David Deal. Then we're going to have Johnny Santiago and Jim Chu. And then we're going to have Julian Mohammed.
It's basically I coined this show the bad boys of food, because everybody here, if you look, they're all these edgy looking guys that are doing amazing things in restaurants and food and managing and stuff.
So why don't you introduce your friend David?
I knew David for a long time, but David Deal is a graduate of Hobart University with a degree in journalism. Is currently the GM of 205th in Park Slope, Brooklyn. It's open 25 years. Bar and restaurant has become a landmark institution in the world of casual neighborhood dining. It has seen many changes over the years, but 205th is stronger than ever. David oversees the business and manages the large sporting events that the broadcast on a daily basis. His background and focus in journalism covering sports and alternative subcultures has been a perfect balance for his passion of working in the business. He is here to talk about the restaurant as well as writing articles on various subjects. One in particular, the world of tattoos. He'll give us his take on where the trend is so popular in the world of young chefs. To the studio, David Deal. Hey, what's up, buddy?
Hey, how's it going?
Can you talk a little? 200 has been around forever. It's been there 25 years. I remember Marty Markowitz gave the owner, Mark Gerbisch, a big award because it had been a landmark restaurant before anyone ever moved anything to Park Slope. He was one of the first places. Can you talk a little bit about the history of the restaurant?
Sure. First off, thanks for having me. Mark opened the place prior to 1986 when the neighborhood wasn't really up and booming at all. And over the years, the place has expanded, and now the neighborhood is kind of coming up more and more, and more places are opening up. But we were one of the first ones there.
You're pretty far out. I mean, Park Slope, are you near 9th Street or 5th Street?
It's 5th Avenue and Union Street.
5th Avenue and Union Street.
Yeah, okay. It's pretty close to 9th, but it's right, it's in that sort of segment of that whole, like where the stadium is. The new stadium's 2-minute walk away.
Basically, and that's going to be something that's going to affect us as well.
Do you think, you guys are doing...
We should describe this place first, because I went there for the first time, and I fell in love with it really, you know, authentically, even before knowing that you guys knew each other. I mean, first of all, this place has 80 televisions.
80 flat-screen TVs, yes.
80. And then it's kind of divided into two places. One is more fine dining, traditional seating zone. And then in the bigger part, it's actually tons of family booths almost for two or four people to sit and basically have their own television.
Right. When the place originally opened, it was one side, one building that was more of a dining room. And as time went by, it opened up into more of a sports bar side. So the second side has more of the TVs where you kind of go there in order to watch, you know, whatever game you choose.
That's really cool, because I've gone in there and watched games, and you literally, like, the technology is there now. You can walk in and just tell the bartender, hey, you know, I'm for boss and I want to watch the Bruins game, and then they'll put it on a specific TV.
How do you navigate that? I mean, do you have to sign up to like 100 different cable programs around the country?
Basically, yeah. We have a really good television company that we work with called JD Systems, and they set up a whole touch screen, and we have a certain amount of boxes, and each TV is numbered. And when we assign a box, you know, we can put whatever game on that you want on whatever TV you're in front of.
And do you need to, for instance, get satellites and all these different media tools to be able to broadcast, all like Vios and Verizon? There's all these competitive...
Right, well, Time Warner and Digital Cable, and then we actually just added ESPN3 as well.
Okay. What is that?
I mean, ESPN3 is the internet.
Oh, like, is it?
We literally just added this.
Is that legal?
Yes.
Okay. That's my... Sorry. You don't just get the softball questions here. No, let's talk a little bit about... Because I feel like my working in restaurants all the time, my comfort food is I love going to get burgers and stuff. And I know I talk a lot with Patrick, and he talks a lot about that. But and sports bars are doing buffalo wings and stuff like that. It never gets enough credit. But the food at 200 is really good. I mean, you can sit down there and you can have either wings or you can get a steak and stuff. Can you talk a little bit about the menu?
I'm the biggest fan of our kitchen. We really have a great kitchen, and our menu that we produce is really quality food. And a lot of places, that like chain places, the sports bar places, their food is, it doesn't need to be good because we provide another service. But what we have is really quality stuff.
It's very unusual. Pushes bar food 4 or 5 notches. I mean, you have, am I wrong? You have like shellfish, like oysters all that. Yeah. And then you also have just like everything you want, you know? And when people go that to that extreme and just give you oysters but don't give you a good burger, you know, it's equally annoying. But you've really tried to do it all and introduce better tasting food at sporting bars.
Let's talk about a couple of big events now. You know, being such a cultured kid myself from Staten Island, you know, growing up with the World Cup, joke, but I think like the first time I really got introduced to how big the World Cup was is when I came to the place like 4 years ago, and it was huge. Can you talk a little bit about different, not typical American sports, but how big the World Cup was this year for you guys and even the Women's World Cup?
Well, for years and years and years, you know, Mark Gerber's the owner of the place, who was really a pioneer in opening the place, didn't really focus on soccer, but now we've seen, like, the World Cup was incredible for us. It really was, and people really kind of hopped on the train, and when the United States was playing well, we were packed. It was really great, and it was a really fun thing to be a part of. Even for the Women's World Cup, once they kind of caught some light under the pop culture kind of thing too, like, you know, they started playing really well and winning in dramatic fashion. We had a line out the door for the Women's World Cup.
Yeah.
Which ethnic groups came out? Because, of course, soccer, there's like one game going on at a time. So did you have like Brazilians coming in when Brazil played, Argentinians when Argentina?
It was mostly the United States as far as the Women's World Cup goes.
Okay.
And the crowd that we received was very diverse all the way through. During the Men's World Cup, you know, we saw everybody. I mean, people wanted to see every group
and
play.
And 200 is like one place that you can go to. You're talking about clientele and stuff that if you speak up too soon, like you could get beat up. I mean, I'm not saying it's like a rowdy place, but it's definitely a specific kind of a place that you can go to. And it's not a sports bar where I go like to say Stout in Midtown, and then there's like a, you know, a bunch of people watching one specific game and then this. But it's definitely, people get really into their sports there, right? I mean, they'll get behind their teams. Like,
absolutely. I mean, the place can really get electric from at any sporting event. I mean, the guys on staff, we talk about either going to a game or being at 200. I mean, it really is electric.
Because football season is coming up now, and that's probably like, it's probably the busiest time for you. Can you talk to me a little?
Football's the best sport, right? It's, I mean, amazing. I imagine more than baseball. I mean, it just seems like the biggest activity.
Football
action.
Sundays, because it happens. Well, I mean, now it happens almost. There's Thursdays, Sundays, Mondays, but Sunday football. Excuse me. You can watch every game, and so that happens once a week, and so yeah, it's our biggest time.
Patrick, what's your team? Jets?
Giants. I was a huge Marino fan growing up, and then when he retired after this botched Achilles tendon operation. I probably went 5-10 years without caring. Although I have to say, how can you not love the Jets? I mean, they're an exciting, fun team. But most of the time, I cheer for the Giants.
Our Jets fans are licking their chops right now. They're really hungry that this is their year.
Yeah, they have Burris, right?
Yes, they do.
They got a very good team. They've been to the division finals two years in a row.
This is really interesting stuff, guys. All right, let's backtrack.
No, it's great for sports.
No, I know it's great for sports, but I'm sorry, I'm not a, I don't tune in that much. I mean, is who's on the Jets now? Is Brett Favre still on that team? Is Brett Favre still playing?
So let's talk about the economics of a very big space. Like, how do you introduce these good foods, pay for 80 televisions, and still keep the prices competitive?
Well, I can answer that. It's a joke.
What's that? No. You know, we've been there for a long time, and you know, Mark owns the building and stuff like that, so we don't have to pay the rent and that.
I mean, I thought about this a lot because we were doing an interview with you and stuff like that. But sports bar is really your business model is created on the sports end. Like, you don't really need to. Like, all the work is done by the programmers and stuff. All you really need to do is create a great environment. And I feel like that's what 205th does. It basically creates the environment and the perfect viewing experience for sports. And then all that other work of what... It's insane. Like, all of a sudden, you know, it's like by accident that baseball season's coming to an end and football season starts and all this sort of marketing and things like that. But you guys definitely provide an amazing... venue to watch it, and I love going there to watch games. Patrick, when was the last time you were there?
I go there for you know.
You seem nearly pretty
certain
recent.
Sporting events. I was there boxing. For three games of the NBA finals.
But boxing too, you said?
Yeah, there was these two guys boxing. One guy lost, the other guy won. But I don't really remember. It was like two middleweight guys, you know. Boxing, I mean, it's too bad that boxing is such a corrupt sport, because I'm sure back in the day, there were a lot of really huge Marvin Hagler, Sugar Ray Leonard, you know, these Mike Tyson, Holmes, those were big fights, you know, and people would really come and pay a lot of money to be in a fun environment for it. Now, I mean, when was the last big heavyweight fight you can remember?
No, heavyweight fights there aren't anymore, but we're waiting for Mayweather and Pacquiao. We're going to close the whole place down.
Is that a big one? Yeah.
That would be it. I mean, we're just waiting for it. I mean, Mayweather's coming up with his next fight, so...
Well, Dave, you don't just, I mean, you also dive in a lot of different things. You do, you know, you're a journalist. I've read a lot of your articles. Can you talk, well, one, we're going to talk about chefs, tattoos, sleeves. But before that, could you talk a little about some interviews that you've done and your journalism background?
Sure. Yeah, I graduated in 05, and I've been writing for different magazines, YRB, Inked Magazine, City Search, Nerve.com. I actually just did an interview with Sean Merriman from the Buffalo Bills.
He played for the Chargers.
Yes.
He was a defensive back. No, linebacker. Like a linebacker. Yeah.
We could talk a little bit more.
I just did that. Yeah, I'm just kind of wrapping that article up. A lot of it was about tattoos as well. He has a lot.
What did he have to say about him?
One of the things we talked about was, you know, Cam Newton. Just started as
Heisman Trophy winner.
Right, correct. And the owner of that team just said that he doesn't want him to get any tattoos or piercings and all that. So we kind of talked about that, and he said, you know, Cam Newton should do whatever he wants.
Yeah.
You know, it's his body, you know, this and that. Who cares about image and all that? And obviously Sean Merriman is very heavily involved in the tattoo culture.
Well, it's you know, Steinbrenner was famous for that. No long hair, no beards.
No beards.
Yeah, he was like, if you play for me, I own your body.
Are the Suns kind of taking that over, or is it just?
Well, Damon pushed the envelope. I think it's still maintained. So they're also not allowed to do those weird like NBC games, like where they're playing with Justin Timberlake and supermodels. You'll never see a New York Yankee doing any of those weird kind of celebrity sporting events.
Really? But Alex Rodriguez has done all those photo shoots, those weird photo shoots that he's been in Complex. And
yeah, but he does it on the... I mean, yeah, doesn't he sort of tick at his own kind
he's
of...
Outside
yeah,
rules, he's outside the rules, I guess.
But can you... This is an interesting thing, and we spoke about this like 2 weeks ago. Like I said, chefs and ink and tattoos and sleeves and stuff. Why, like I said, rather than going out there and asking a million people, like, because you've done a lot, you did your sort of dissertation on tattoos and stuff. Why do you think chefs kind of get so much ink, and what is that all about?
Like I said to you, I think I only have one answer for that, and I think chefs, you know, they're culinary artists, and I think they're kind of attracted to to art, and in the same way, you know, tattoo artists. And I think that's why they're kind of driven to get work done.
Just because they're working with their arms and kind of...
Well, right. I think they appreciate the whole culture of it.
And I think there's like a couple of ways to show that you're like not subversive, but that you don't rely on the usual routine of, you know, 9-to-5 jobs. You're probably working harder, but you're just doing things late at night, is like facial hair or tattoos.
But it definitely started somewhere, because I would love to see, and it's definitely chefs that probably know this, who started, like who was the first chef to kind of like get all that? Because I mean, if you talk about like 2000 and like sort of late, you know, late 90s and all those chefs, like you didn't see it a lot there, and all of a sudden like 2004, 2005, you've seen a lot.
I think it was Karem. Karem, he was the first one. Back in like 1600, he had all these little marzipan creatures drawn on him.
I'll take references from the 17th century for $300, please.
Who was the first? Well, then there's a famous chef that has Alice Waters' face tattooed on him.
Yeah. I think that's kind of creepy. Here's my sustainable tattoo.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, yeah, tattoos. I don't know when that first came. I mean, tattoos are...
It definitely has come with this new crop of chefs. But I mean, I know chefs had a lot of ink, but the sleeve... I talk about the sleeve aspect of it. You know, I've seen it with this whole new generation. And I see with a lot of young line cooks now, they're just like sort of starting their sort of road to sleeves. So they'll come in, they'll get like 3 tattoos.
Do you have any tattoos?
I do, but mine are like tattoos you get when you grew up in Staten Island.
I don't want to know anymore. No, but so what do you, when you write about, back to the interview, when you start writing about things like tattoos, I mean, you'll come up with an idea and then you'll approach the different publications and kind of pitch it or something like that, or it's an observation you have?
Like I said, I'm a freelance writer, and I do pitch, you know, my editors with ideas, but often they'll come to me with assignments, certain people to interview, and then we just kind of talk about the inspiration behind it and the work they've had done and with who that they've had it.
So how much of how important is the theater of this massive sports bar that you run for your ideas? Because you must really see all walks of life in a very pure, almost, you know, ecstasy state.
Well, I think it's important. I think it's helped me. I think all of us could probably agree that working in the restaurant service industry has helped us learn a lot about people, because you meet new people and you learn about different walks of life and the same walks of life and you kind of move forward that way through relationships.
Are people more high maintenance or low maintenance in an environment where they're like watching television?
I guess that could go both ways. In one effect, you know, they're watching TV, so you don't have to worry about them as much. Or in the other end, you know, that they might be more demanding.
Yeah, because they like want their remote. You know, they want
as soon as the game
power.
Ends, they want something else.
Yeah,
well, that's it's definitely you deal with a lot of different stuff because you're creating a theatrical experience on top of food and everything. So you have a lot of, and God forbid something happens with the feed and it goes out for 2 seconds and it's the NBC's problem, but like they blame it. They look at you as the manager. Oh, like, hey, what's going on here? But it's interesting experience, but I want to thank you for coming down.
Yeah, thanks so much.
To the show. We're talking about 205th. Once again, David Deal from
one of the best sports bars in the city. Really,
it is,
I really mean that.
I mean 100% too, and then you know, just Google it as well.
And it's a diverse crowd. I really like that. It's not your typical Park Slope crowd. When you think Park Slope, that's, it's a different stereotype.
You think strollers and stuff. No, yeah, exactly.
No strollers allowed.
Dave, any,
no, we have strollers
allowed.
Too.
Dave, any sort of 205th.coms or anything you want to
mention? Yeah, 205-200-FIF.
And you guys are kicking...
They hate kids.
And you guys are kicking it off on Thursday for the first
Thursday
game.
Is the first day of NFL, and... we expect to be a lot of fun.
Man. And if I wanted to see a game on Sunday, what time should I come or should I make a reservation?
You have to get there at 7 a.m. That's the only thing.
7 a.m.
No,
yes.
Literally. People start showing up there at 10 for the games.
At noon would be a good start.
Cool.
Can you serve alcohol at 10 a.m.?
No.
No, you have to start
only
at
Roberta's.
All right. Well, we will be back with our next guest, Johnny Santiago and Jimmy Chu. Thanks so much
Thanks,
for coming
Dave.
Out, Dave.
Cheers. Awesome.
Thank you, guys.
Oh no! So I face the final curtain. You can't, I'm not the queer. I'll state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full. With each and every highway has it much more than this. I did it my way.
We're back. I just want to say, Jason, I really mean this. Of all the people I've ever hosted with, you were in my top 15.
15?
And I mean that.
Wow.
So, yeah.
I love that joke.
Thanks for everything.
I was waiting. Usually it comes like in a third segment. The.
So has this show made you more popular with your friends? Are they all like responding to your tweets more often now, begging to be on the show?
I don't know if it's made me more popular, but it's definitely made me more annoying because I'm like... Did you listen? Did you live?
Was that on
I couldn't. I tried to get on live. They're like, no. Did you download it? Like, we downloaded it. We listened to it.
I'm like, so introduce us to our next guest. We have a full studio right here.
This studio is very full, and I'm pulling it up right now. Johnny Santiago and Jim Chu are from Joe's, and I'll read their bio here. Johnny Santiago and Jim Chu are in the studio.
Hello.
Lifelong friends who have created a partnership in an industry filled with large egos. They have found a perfect marriage with their partnership and their joint venture, Joe's. An abbreviation on Johnny's mother name, Josephine. Joe's opened in 2009, located on Elizabeth Street, just south of Houston. Joe's is a neighborhood bar restaurant that attracts all walks of life without pretension. The food follows that same path, giving customers what you would expect from a neighborhood bar and restaurant, classic standards without any fluff. Johnny and Jim are both New York City fixtures and have distinguished careers in industry in all areas respectively. They're in the studio to talk about Joe's, other projects, and also discuss how they have seen this change over the past two decades downtown. No, I love putting respectively in there. It makes me think about high school mathematics, equations or something. You
know, like, it sounded really serious.
Respectively.
As you were talking, I was waiting for those guys to come in, and I realized, wait, that's supposed to be us.
Yeah,
Guys, that was Jim Chu talking, and then we have Johnny. Can you
there we go.
Say hello? Hello. Okay,
hello,
cool.
Hello.
Guys, thank you a lot for coming into the studio. I have to say first that out of a lot of restaurant people that I know, I have a tremendous amount of respect for you guys. And what you're doing at Joe's, and I know you guys have been in the industry for a really long time and are both New York City guys. And
What do you like so much about it?
Well, the thing about, other than the bio, I mean, if you, on any given night, they're on the floor, they're in the kitchen,
okay.
They're in receiving goods in the morning, they're closing out the restaurant, counting money. You know, it's not one of these deals where there's a huge marketing department and a huge staff, and they have call-ins for staff. Like, if somebody doesn't show up, they're working on top of the fact that they worked at a couple of places, one on Ludlow Street in particular called Torch, which when I was a kid I used to go to a lot.
It was a kid.
And we'll talk about that. But can you guys talk about Joe's and Jim?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's sort of like this is where a place where Johnny and I really have known each other for more than a little while. I think it's long enough at the point that neither of us actually wants to discuss the number of years.
Yeah, no.
But it's been a while, and we had a couple of projects before. We did own a restaurant called Torch together, and we did spend a lot of time in downtown and in Brooklyn.
So talk about Ludlow and Torch, that whole...
Well, Torch was... it was great because there was nothing like it at the time, and the only reason we were able to do it because Ludlow Street was like a crackdown.
What made it unique?
He had pianos, Bar Mundi.
Yeah, pianos wasn't even there yet. I mean, it was basically Max Fish, Ludlow Street Cafe, and Motor City.
And
a bunch of drug dealers.
Having a 74-seat, 20-foot ceiling, white tablecloth restaurant, I mean, it was truly insane.
But it was, yeah, I mean, it was a supper club. There was live jazz every night, like Tony Bennett sang there, Prince Paul DJ'd there, the band Live, they performed there. It's like these people, Nora Jones before she was...
You know, I made her. No, I mean, you could essentially, I remember, you'd go there. There was a doorman outside, but it wasn't like a club environment doorman. You'd go in, you'd sit down, you'd have dinner, and then in between your dinner, there would be a sort of a crooner, like in the middle of the restaurant. And we had those old-fashioned microphones.
Yeah, cage mic. Yeah, it was based on, I mean, the idea came from in a Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
You know when she's singing?
Yeah,
the camera's like panning the room, and Dennis Hopper's like sucking the gas, and no one's paying attention to her. So it's that, and just an old black and white photo of, you know, old Hollywood, and that was, you know, the whole idea behind it was from those.
That
moments.
Whole neighborhood had a cool subculture. I remember Sapphire Club was one of the few places where you could just go and dance and not have to spend a lot of money. And then there was another one like right on that same block.
Bob is still there, and Sapphire's. I own a White Rabbit around the corner from there, which I've had since it was Den of Thieves, just like 16 years that spanned this whole... That's a whole other giant conversation. But we came out of that era, and we saw a lot of things had changed. And after like 2002, Johnny and I were just always looking for a place. And we looked... It seemed like we were like one step ahead of where we really needed to be. Like, and we were out on Fifth Avenue looking at places in Brooklyn. We were on Second Avenue looking at Mermaid Inn when it was still like a Burmese restaurant. We were in Harlem.
We almost opened across from Brooklyn Brewery.
Across from Brooklyn Brewery.
Amazing.
We were looking
it's
at
that
a place.
Skate
so
shop
now. From what you had learned at your first places together, and you saw things had changed, so you were going to kind of change what you knew. You were looking for something different. So what was that thing?
And for us, it was about also... As we changed, we wanted to create a place that was really suiting like what we love to do, and that is having a bar that you could come to that had its own sort of vitality, but you could eat, and then a dining room, and then a separate space that could be private but connected to the dining room. And literally walking down the street, Johnny was still in LA, and I saw this place, and I was like, I mean, very specific things that we over the years after looking at all these places, like we want to be able to have this sort of energy that flows through, and because sometimes it just needs to suit. It's so hard to get people together.
Yeah,
and it's just like, you know, this so and so is getting out at 6, so and so is getting out at 8. If you actually want to sit down and have dinner, it's never going to happen. So you sit down like you do at Roberta's, grab a drink, start to eat. Other people meet up. You come outside. It starts out as a 4-top, turns into an 8-top. Turns back into a 4-top. The third shift is in. The original people that started the party, they're in bed. They're like with their kids.
And somebody's left with a tab.
I know. And then someone's
right,
like,
exactly. And that
I've
and
only
that would
contributed
be,
$28 exactly. from everyone that
but
was
the,
here.
The exactly. space is the old tasting room. Is
it's the old tasting room, but for us, it's the old M&R bar.
Yeah, back.
It's and actually, when the M&R bar opened,
to me, it's where I grew up across the street from Marty Scorsese. That's
exactly. It's I mean that's a neighborhood place.
Very nice. So tell us about Joe's. Like, what's on the menu?
Disco fries. No.
Disco fries.
Yeah,
enough
no, no.
Said.
We're basically like steak, chops, ribs place, but without that sign, you know? Like that kind of old
you know, the standards.
Yes, and then you also have the oyster sort of happy hour thing that you guys.
Yeah, we actually stopped doing the oyster happy hour thing, but we always have something at the bar that's substantial, that's good. Right now we're doing like a slow cooked pulled pork shoulder with little sliders.
Pork sliders, yeah.
But I put on the question, which was, you guys were doing the whole animal dinners before it was cool, and you guys have been doing the whole pork. You hope like a suckling pig kind of buyout.
Oh yeah, yeah. I don't know how that ever wasn't cool. I mean, I think
growing up in Chinatown.
Yeah, I mean, like, you ask anyone who's like Chinese or Latino, I think that the first person to
the times is like first person to ever roast a duck at the table.
No, but now it's such a selling point for a lot of places. Yeah. It's like it's been going on for a while, and you guys never advertise the fact, and that's the reason why, because it just was the main
exactly. And it's all about sharing a lot of our dinners, our family style. We do we have this back room that's
the Albert Room.
The Albert Room is seats 44, and it does. We do a lot of like rehearsal dinners and that kind of thing, and for us. I mean, we could do plated dinners, but having that family style, that physical action of like passing food around is so, it's like people are sharing in that hospitality that we love to share with
them. And also they're portioning food the way they want to.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
So if you don't like peppers, you don't have to have a big pile of them on your plate.
Exactly.
Yeah. What are your guys' roles now in terms of like who's doing the invoicing and I know you guys are all over the place most of the time when the place is operating.
Are you in the kitchen, either one of you, or no?
We were last weekend.
Yeah, Jim. Okay. Let's have a good hurricane story here.
Yeah, we haven't had any good Irene.
Can you tell the Irene story? Because you guys opened Saturday night.
Yeah, our staff couldn't get in. Part of our role is that
we do whatever it takes.
That's our one job, is we do whatever it takes.
Yeah.
That's absolutely right. And part of our job is that we have to save each other from ourselves.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm like, let's open the whole restaurant. We cook everything.
Yeah, so we got one of our investors. He shot up to Harlem to pick up our one bartender that actually lives in Manhattan.
Because she realized, I'm losing my Saturday.
Yeah.
What the hell?
So he goes, he picks her up, and we're like...
Because you couldn't get around, obviously. No subways.
Yeah, no subways, nothing. So we're like, okay, we're going to cook. So, I got one arm. And so we're like 2.5 people now. And so she's at the bar, and Jim's in the kitchen, and I'm kind of doing whatever, and all these people show up.
People start calling in.
People are calling in.
Have you guys nine top at 8:00?
Yeah, we had people I want to make a reservation for nine people. We're like,
and
what?
And it's great. So our regulars are showing up and
yeah, two of our regulars. One starts barbacking. The other one starts bussing tables and
but
running.
But then we have a guy who's stoned on what's obviously the best medical marijuana.
Yeah,
because he walks in and I'm like,
how I found out about geocaching. By the way,
as dramatic as it sounds, there's two tickets in the window, and I'm like, oh my god! And Dirk is standing there, and he's gigantic. He's 230 pounds. He's like, I would help you right now. I could flip some burgers, but
I might eat them.
I'm really, really stoned. And then just but the thing is, we actually ended up doing
it was an amazing night all around.
Yeah,
it was so much fun.
A sous chef from Momofuku runs in and goes you guys rock! I can't believe you're open! And they just left.
Patrick, I know you agree with me, but that's the times when you really tragedy in New York City, you just love it because everybody really comes together and puts aside everything and is really appreciative, and especially coming to restaurants and they just are really happy.
Oh, yeah, our locals were...
Yeah, it was a blast.
It was
everyone's
the best.
Walking in and out of the kitchen.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Patrick, my dad came down, and the Albert Room is named after a restaurant that he owned in the 60s. And for whatever reason, my dad was like, hurricane equals suit. So he's wearing hurricane. I went out and bought a head-to-toe vinyl highway road thing, and my dad's like, I think I'm gonna go with the pinstripe. Mm. Gets downstairs and he's rocking the dish station. He's like, "Where do you want these sizzle plates?"
Wait, your dad?
Was he ready?
My dad.
What?
Was he ready? He thought it could be the end of the
world. Yeah,
he wanted to go out in style.
No, he had already done his hurricane proofing, so he came down with my brother, who's also he writes for cookbooks and stuff. And so my brother comes down. He's like, "How can I help?" He's like, "Grab the mussel ticket. Get me a 3-quart saucepan, hot. Sizzle up the serrano peppers. Hit it with the curry powder." He's like, "Got it." He's jumped in. I'm like, "That's
That was great. Well, that was a blast.
The city and weather. I mean, blizzards brings people together, you know, where you help people undo their cars or whatever. Yeah. And then there's just roving groups of people that help, and you give them $5, you know, even, and they'll take you out.
You know, even after, I mean, we're coming up on the 10th anniversary, after September 11th, it was like, you know, that month after, you can go into any bad neighborhood and you could just start doing a jig and be like, hey, guys, we're like, rolling it together. Like, I mean, as bad as
it was.
There
was no horn honking for a month. You know, there was.
Yeah, everybody was pretty chill. But
so, day 31 was a little different.
Are you guys going into the third year? Is that kind of that's amazing, but congratulations on that.
Yeah, we're at the 2.5 mark right now.
It's every year is someone.
It's like
else.
Dog years.
Right.
Fucking dog years.
Oh, it's like the first year. After you get the first year. Well, no, after you get the second. Well, I mean, now that you're in second year, I'm like, oh my God.
You're in the third year.
It's still the restaurant business.
Now, you guys are on Houston Street, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. Just off.
Houston is my favorite two-way east-west thoroughfare.
Why?
Can I ask you this?
What is it competing with?
Well, exactly. Right. What are the other competitors? What are the other competitors?
Well, I mean, you have to go up to 72nd Street, 57th, 72nd before you get real nice. But Houston Street's also a weird street. The way it has that island.
It's a divided highway.
The buildings are kind of a little bit further removed off of the sidewalk. So it's kind of never really been one neighborhood or another. Houston was its independent.
It's a conveyance. It's sort of like a neutral zone.
So how has that been? Like, do you have the same people traffic that other people have? Or, I mean, how has that neighborhood changed?
Well, it's funny. Elizabeth Street is like the beautiful street that everyone's like, oh my God, I love it.
It's full
of beautiful women. Yeah,
shop girls, all this stuff. Yeah.
And then it's just really quiet. And then you turn the corner and there's like Polina's and it's like, like you leave work at the end of the night, it's like, oh my God, what is going on?
It's a shock. Actually, walking up Bowery, I mean, I don't even. I ride.
I miss the bumps.
I don't.
I miss the bumps.
Yeah,
I do. I'm sorry, Jason.
It's okay.
Now they're actually changing it because I guess the subway line's going to go right there now, right?
Well, that's not going to happen for the Second Avenue one.
Yeah, I think they're already building.
No, it's happening. I'm just saying it's happening, but I'm saying it's.
There's a lot of construction on Houston right now.
Oh yeah,
they're moving it down. I mean, it started. You know, all the way west is moving itself east, but that sort of like revitalization of like whatever they're restructuring under
the T train,
the T, that's what it's gonna be called. The T,
isn't that what they call it in Boston?
Can you?
I don't know.
Well, I've always thought that that's bad because if you were a business owner on Houston Street with all that crazy construction for 10 years, I mean, the city shouldn't be allowed. I mean, I don't know.
It's been going on and everyone's dealt with it there. But, you know, the first part about any construction is when you're dealing with anything and they dig up the streets, or like there's a rat infestation. And on top of that, then you got you're just like people working there for 2 years and then they sort of like they're done, but they're sort of staging of equipment, and then it's like, okay, well, can we get rid of this stuff? I mean, it was at the Puck building and now it's kind of moving itself down, but I think you guys have a huge neighborhood following, but also there's a ton of industry people there. I mean, I think that's how I kind of became friends with you guys, because I went in there and I was talking to them. I was like, wow, these guys are like, they're owners, but they're like,
but they drink.
Industry. They're industry people. And I looked around, you know, one day and I was like, wow, it's like, I know half the people on this bar just from.
I think that they, you know, they share our passion. They see that how much we're involved in it, which always confuses me a little bit, because people are so, I don't know, they're really, it's sort of inspired by our involvement or they like the way that we run our business. And I think like, well, how else is there a way to do it? So apparently there's, you know, I mean, Patrick, you know that there's a lot of people in this business apparently that make money. I've read about it. But that they're in it for something else. I mean, the only reason why I do this is that
to cook in a hurricane.
Yeah, to cook in a hurricane.
But you're giving people an experience. I mean, you're giving these people like the highlight of their week or day.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what is that? How is that? I'm so interested because there's so many bad restaurants out there, ones that just don't get it. Yeah. Like, that's why Roberta's is so universally loved, because it gets it. Mm. You know, your place gets it. I mean, can you break down the grammar of that for young restaurateurs who are listening out there?
I think it's, you know, you just got to...
Julian Muhammad.
Have fun. Yeah, yes, listen, Julian. You just got to really enjoy what you're doing. And you have to have fun and kind of, you know, whatever you think the rules are, or, well, this place does it like that. It's just treat people the way you want to be treated and open the place that you want to go to.
And you should have a big bar. I mean, should the bar?
We should have a bigger bar.
They wanted it to be bigger in the beginning, yes. But then I think, yeah, right?
I think for the size that it is where we are right now, it feels like it should be bigger. But I think that it's because
nobody knows we have two dining rooms in the back.
Is behind it. That it does take eventually. Well, it's going to be. It is the perfect size. It's just takes some time for things to balance out. But I think a bar is really important because also what we've discovered, I think, is brunch is really important just because people have their guard down.
Mm-hmm.
I think that when people come into dinner, and it's very challenging to know if people are walking, it's like, this is their first date. No, it's their last date.
No, or, it's both. They met on OkCupid.
They're business. They're coworkers who are having sex. Like, and to what degree like that has anything to do with first? It's like, it's brunch. People are mortally wounded. They have about like 33 hours before they're
dealing with family,
and all they want is permission to have vodka in the daytime. And like, I'll to everyone who can hear me, yes, it's okay.
But
more than that, it's encouraged.
Talking about the amount of respect you guys get outside of just within the industry, because I mean, you guys obviously you don't have any marketing teams or anything like that. But I'm on Eater.com or something, and I'll see either an article by Jim Chu or Johnny Santiago, a response to a Yelp thing or something. But those blogs, whatever it could be, they don't pick up anything. Just, you know, there's always something, somebody with a advertising, you know, tie-in or PR firm tie-in. But like, Jim is extremely articulate in his your articles that you write about industry stuff, and it's amazing. And then Johnny had an amazing re-review for a Yelp thing about somebody that came in. Can you guys talk about just like that whole avenue of how you guys do your, you know, advertising?
I don't know that I think it's
or
like,
whatever. We're just getting good jokes.
No, but it's like this.
It's venting. We're venting.
It's venting. And it's really having. Like, this is such a great forum. I mean, it's obviously it's new to us, but to be able to, that people are actually interested in our opinion and in our experience. And the guys at Eater are that same way. And
yeah, they're awesome.
It's different from, I think, other forums that are about one
shout
thing.
Out, shout out to Amanda Kludes.
Oh, shout out to Amanda and Greg, definitely.
Do you feel you need a PR firm if you're a restaurant in the city?
No, we fired ours.
Yeah.
No, you know what? It's funny because when, you know, Open Torch, I mean, we were like one of the first restaurants to have a website. There was no Yelp. There, you know, nobody, the internet was like, what the fuck's that? I think the first, like the IMAX just came out, you know? It's like, it's a colored computer, you know? Yeah. And so that time difference between opening this, everything has changed and kind of learned a big lesson from when we first opened because it just wasn't prepared. Like, people don't discover things the way they used to. And so part of our, you know, all this, these things we're getting involved like with Eater and just trying to get stuff out is because this is how people discover things. Mm-hmm. It used to be, you always had one friend that always go, it's like, no, you got to call Jason because he's got his ear to the ground. He knows what's happening. Now everyone's at work, not working. They're on Google. They're like, what's the hot new restaurant? Yeah. And then, you know, boom, they pull up your website. Boom, this is the menu. This is what this Yelper said. Oh, I know what's going to be good. Oh, I know this bartender. She has tattoos. She's snarky. Yeah, Fonzie, you. You know, all this stuff. And
but how is Yelp? Do you think Yelp has heard or helped?
We actually, use Yelp, I think, in the ways, a lot of ways that
for a phone number and an address.
Well, I think personally. But as a restaurant, I think we use it a lot of ways that restaurants do. It's like they're try to look at it that pretty much every review has some element of truth in it.
Yeah.
A lot of it's sort of fueled by alcohol or rage or inadequate feelings of inadequacy. But I mean, if someone feels like they're being neglected, like that comes up. And if there's a pattern, that's absolutely something we bring up with our staff.
Totally.
For us, in a bizarre yet timely, you know, happenstance, when we completely lost control and we did everything you're not supposed to do, which was respond
to bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, if
you were like, dear,
no, Johnny, I don't know if you don't have it on, but Johnny had this. I mean, it was an amazing thing to a thing that
response
was on Yelp,
to a Yelper, yeah.
That was like, it was just such an ignorant response, like a Yelp thing, and then Johnny like basically laid, it was great.
But
and
you know, got, there's this thing
went,
now.
It went viral. It went viral.
The M. Wells thing, also about the reviewer not always being, you know, there was something the GQ
right
reviewer.
With Alan. Yeah.
This was some.
Right.
This was some shoemaker girl that went into his restaurant. Some girl that probably went to Boston University and like was in a sorority or something.
I personally think it's only followed by us. within the industry, which, by the way, I swear to God, I do not follow. I don't own a restaurant, so there's no need to. I think we have 4 Yelp reviews for our heritage turkeys.
You look at it. But, you look at
but
it.
But we don't look at it. I just think it's a culture reporting on ourselves, so we all look to it, plus some other Americans. But I think if you want a powerful thing like Zagat, that sounds like millions and billions of people use that. Yelp? Does it make
Yelp gets more traffic. I think that to Johnny's point is that it doesn't make or break. Like, no one thing does. Now it's 95 things that as a collective do. But
or the health department.
Tim and Nina,
of that one thing.
That's another meaning. We're a big part of the 80s and early 90s like restaurant with the Zagat book. But so I give them a lot of respect. But they've really fallen off the radar in terms of what people look for. I mean, I would say Yelp 100%.
But
more
what's always been
people look to Yelp before going down. 100%.
Oh yeah, because it's volume wise, absolutely
100%. Because I mean, Zagat originally was associated as a book, and then they have a website. And stuff. No, I know, but I'm saying, but people, they turn to Yelp first.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah. But what's amazing to me actually is that they didn't have the self-awareness to know that they were the first Yelp. It did start virally. They started off with a mimeograph machine. They sent it out to their friends, and their friends gave them their opinions, which they turned anonymously into scores, which were shared with other people. It's like, does that sound familiar at all? Mm-hmm. And then when they saw that, they didn't see themselves coming, and then
They wanted to charge for it.
They wanted to charge for it. They had.
Have charged for website advertising and
Patrick,
all that.
Do you find that?
What's like Carlo Petrini, the founder of Slow Food, who was like, why was it not the Italians that were on the coffee trend in America? You know, he was always frustrated. There was some idiot in Seattle that made an ugly coffee house.
Something tells me he's still angry.
What's with the mermaid with the split tail? I don't get it.
Oh, there's a whole story.
It freaks me out.
Yeah.
Patrick, do you find anything with Heritage in terms of reviews and stuff, in companies and stuff, or it's just word of mouth? It's just basically purchasers or chefs that are talking about the food. I mean, if you go online, I mean, there's no Yelp reviews.
I think farmers, and we are not one, we're just distributors, but we kind of are responsible for the supplies, the animal herds being raised, because these are the endangered species kind. So I think the farmers always get some benefit of the doubt. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You don't really want to be like,
just throwing
that red wattle hog was disgusting, and I'm going to say. But like when it is with a commodity, I think it's okay to say it because they have no excuse. You know, we're like the one herd of that pig in the whole country. So I don't know.
So you don't get that.
We're a distributor. So I guess we're like, doesn't really affect us. Lafrida's a distributor. He gets a lot of press, but he's making his own thing with his burgers.
Himself out there,
yeah, too. He's actually creating something.
Once again, we're out here with Johnny Santiago and Jim Chu. And guys, can you talk about, there's some events coming up.
Yeah.
You guys can talk about. There's an annual Labor Day event.
The second annual fucking delicious pancake eating contest tomorrow at 4 p.m.
And if anyone wanted, is it all booked already? If anyone,
you
might get a million.
We have 30 contestants right now, but some people they pussy out. So come down if you want to get in. Maybe you could get in a slot.
And what is that all about? Pancake in a contest? What are the rules?
Well, the rules are you have to use a knife and fork because they're fucking delicious. You can't no dunking in water and all that crap.
Yeah, Joe had very specific things. She said you can eat whatever you want, but don't be an animal.
Yes. So, so it's that. You got 5 minutes. Last year, the guy did 35 pancakes in 5 minutes.
Yeah, he was
disgusting.
Yeah, but he was an insider. Yeah. I was really upset.
He tried
to
get in again this year. He said, no.
Wait a second. So you didn't let him in. So this is just like dog eating contest with the Japanese guy.
Well, this is amateur only.
It's amateur only.
It really meant to just sort of be a goof off for it.
Yeah.
I mean, we have definitely people that's, because there's no entry fee, people just sign up for pancakes. I'm like, that's fine.
It's just interesting. Both,
it's a recession. We're doing our part.
All you can eat speed eating contest, the two both have in common someone being banned from competing. It's very interesting. I wonder if it says anything about just all you can eat gluttony, people being banned, anger.
By the way, there's a woman breastfeeding to my left. I just want to point that out.
Oh, that's at 261 Moore Street.
Everyone's got to eat.
That child that was crying in the and he's actually being breastfed.
He's not crying anymore. Nor are we. So why don't we take a break? We'll come back with Julian Mohammed, and then we'll bring everyone in to
talk
about issues like elitism and culture.
This is one they have recorded. It's their latest single, and it's in the charts. Coming to you now live, this is The Seeker.
I've looked on the chairs.
You're looking for me. I'm looking for you.
Sorry, that was my...
Here we are.
Townsend, I don't know. That was
our next
who.
Guest is Julian Mohammed, the managing partner and vibe coordinator of Dear Bushwick. Dear Bushwick opening this fall. When I talk in a lower voice there, it's because it's in parentheses. Julian was born in England in 1977 and grew up during the tumultuous years of the early 1980s. Supertramp was on top of the charts. Oh, no, wait. Which partly explains why, after graduating from the London Metropolitan University with a bachelor's in business studies and 4 successful years of working for corporate UK America, he decided to jump ship and swim for the shores of anything that didn't include sitting behind a desk. Julian had worked in the service industry for the past 5-plus years and decided to open his own place with Emily Sinnott,
who's in the studio.
I believe is in studio with us.
We hope.
The name of the spot is... Dear Bushwick. Dear Bushwick is a subtly English-themed cafe, restaurant, bar. The space will recreate the feel of the late 70s and early 80s England, empowering quintessential working-class decor from the linoleum flooring and the damask wallpaper. A feel that can be summed up as vibrant 70s social club. The menu will primarily feature variations of the Great British Banger, quintessentially English sides, and a few renowned English staples. The dining experience will be supplemented with wines from the colonies, a.k.a. the Commonwealth, and classic English gin cocktails. Dear Bushwick will be affordable and satisfying, just a few blocks from Roberta's, with 30-plus seats inside and 30-plus in the patio.
Amazing. Wow, thank you.
These intros are like books on tape, man.
Hello.
I'm going to go have to sleep now.
I try. I do a lot of work, a lot of prep. Can you...
He used to work at Joe's.
Yeah. For like a week.
I went to Joe's for
and you just 2 days.
What's going on? Well, Julian, I'm sorry.
There's a bit of a history here. Actually.
That's a common disease of people that are on mic. They still want to be on it, and it carries over. It's withdrawal. Can you talk about Dear Bushwick and then when you're planning to open and how the whole idea came about? Because I've been to the space. I saw you kind of like right at that space where somebody needs to sign off on something in terms of the city. Can you talk about it?
Yeah, so we're hoping to open on Halloween. The 31st of October actually marks the beginning of the British Sausage Week. That's kind of significant because we're focusing on the banger.
And banger is, for an ignorant
for
guy,
the, for the Americans that don't know, a banger is a sausage.
So banger and mash, traditional kind of.
And it's called a banger because in the World War II, during rationing, they would fill the bangers up with so much water, they would explode when you would cook them.
Really?
So that's why a banger is called a banger.
And so you don't have an exact date, but you just...
That's what we were shooting for. We had contractor issues. So we've managed to work out some leverage. So we've just lit a fire up his ass. And hopefully we'll be back on track.
Does his name end in a vowel? Your contractor, is he an Italian?
No.
He's
a New Yorker.
Do you want me to call him? I'll put the nail through the wall.
I could finish this by, I could probably finish by Halloween, but if you want it by Halloween, it's going to be about $5,000 more.
I didn't say 2012 or 13.
Hey.
But no, I want to ask, is this going to be all English? Like, is there going to be HP saw, the brown sauce,
yeah,
all that kind
of? Yeah, it's
going to
be English inspired. Originally, we were going to do what a lot of other English restaurants in the city are doing, which is cram every single English dish known by Americans onto the menu. But that's kind of novelty, and I find that even myself, I don't really want to go to these restaurants too often.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll.
Well, how many English restaurants are there truly in New York? I mean, a half dozen, a dozen,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, there's a
not
handful.
Very many.
Yeah, there's a handful. Some of them doing it really well. One that I just went to the other day that I really liked actually was Clerkenwell, but it wasn't particularly busy, and I'm trying to work out. The food was really good, not massively expensive, and I'm trying to work out why. You know, why they're not that busy on a brunch when, you know, the food is kind of brunch focused. And it kind of occurred to me that people don't want to eat English food on a regular basis, which is why I'm focusing the menu on the banger and sides.
Like, why is that the one aspect of English cuisine that you think is accessible day in and day out?
Yeah. I mean, most restaurants in the city have at least one sausage on their menu. Everyone knows what a sausage is. It's the number one food in America, in England, sorry. It's like the number one... in home food, there are like 470 English sausages, and if you take into account the butcher variations, you could probably eat a different sausage every day for 10 years.
And how that's funny. And how many of those will you have? I mean, will you only have one?
We'll have four. We're gonna do one beef, one pork, and one poultry, and a vegetarian option.
Perfect.
And we're gonna pull
all in house.
Well, we're hoping for in house.
At first, we might actually
buy, just because there's a lot of work goes into producing sausages and
100%.
Yeah, so we might actually source them to begin with, and then, you know, we'll see how we fare and how we do in terms of demand in the neighborhood.
English cuisine has never really gotten...
No, well, he called me this week, and he's like, I had one of the questions was like the London food renaissance. He's like, what the hell does that mean? And I was like, no, I don't mean it in a sort of...
Well, I actually did some research on that. I think it lasted 2 weeks in May 2010.
No, I mean, I didn't necessarily mean it... I didn't mean it in the sense of like English food, but I meant it, a lot of operators were going out to London and opening up stuff. I mean, you have Heston Blumenthal out there and stuff, but I mean, like, you know, Danielle is going out there. Keller is doing like a sort of a Bouchon kind of concept out there. There's a lot of people that went out to London, and I mean, it's an extremely expensive place to dine out.
Is that why you chose the 70s theme to show yourself as trying to stay true to the original,
moment? That's the food I grew up on, essentially, is that kind of working class food. Yeah.
You're looking at people come in, have about a 18 to 20 minute sort of like turn around and sit down, have some good food, not get sort of price gouged.
Partly that, but we're also a full service bar, so we're trying to come up with a menu that complements the drinks, so people are happy to come a couple times a week.
But I can't drink a Pimm's cup in December. What are you gonna have on what are you gonna have on the menu in December for the cocktail?
They actually, I think, are credited by Slow Food, the English, for having, I think, invented port and like champagne. Somehow the English were involved, even though they didn't go ahead.
We hate the French.
Yes, it's between the French, the Italians, and English. You guys can all fight over who came up with what first.
Now,
you
know. Regarding these bangers, is there certain regional differences within England, like more pork-centric somewhere, more heavier?
I like the
pipa banger. It's my favorite.
They're complete regional.
I can't believe you brought her up.
Oh, sorry.
The who banger?
The pipa banger.
The pipa banger.
Yeah, Pippa Middleton, sorry.
Oh.
I thought you were English.
I'd banger. Yeah, so can I... Sorry, I'll take that back. So, yeah, primarily the sausages are regional-based, and there are countless.
There a region that's known to do it the best? Or it's kind of working man's food, right?
Yeah, it's everywhere. Like local. Generally, they're local. So there's no... I mean, maybe with some promoting, some baggers get more airplay in England than others, but they're primarily pork-based. Sausages in England are a little bit more watery. I'd say juicier than they are in America. So here, wet, they're very wet. Meaty.
Blood sausage.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
And what in a region did you grow up in?
I grew up in Oxfordshire. Our sausage...
Is that Cockney?
No, it's halfway between the Black Country, not as in black people, but like where the coal mines and stuff were, and London. We would eat a lot of Cumberland sausages, actually, for some reason. We're nowhere near Cumberland, but that was the sausage we would eat the most.
And then what? So you came to the States. What was the first place you worked at in New York City?
I was actually a headhunter when I came to the States.
For
bankers and accountants.
Really? That's hysterical.
It's quite funny.
But after you fell into, like, I'm interested in where you worked.
My very first job was for this crazy Italian guy called Michelle that ran East Post, which is right next to the Mermaid Inn.
It's to the right of it, right?
Yeah. Did you know that guy? He trained me. He was a psycho.
But you probably learned a lot from him.
I did, actually. I learned how to stand up to people like that. But I was a busser for like a week and then a server after a couple of weeks. And then I was like managing within like 3 months, at least a couple of days a week.
And you got the bug.
Got the bug. Well, like everything else in my life wasn't working out, so I kind of stayed within the restaurant industry. And I think I just got to a point right now. Obviously, I've been working in the restaurant industry for a while, and you can only serve for so long. I feel like and you have to decide what you want to do from there. And I can throw a pretty good party, so I can create a decent atmosphere.
Well, I saw your business plan. I mean, the idea of the place, I mean, looks amazing. I do like the name. It's a very unique kind of name, because every time I was telling everybody about the interview, I would say Dear Bushwick, and they're like, what? Oh, that goes like, no, that's the name of the place. So it has a very kind of like non-traditional kind of name to it.
Is Bushwick going to be a challenge for you as a neighborhood?
No, not really. I mean, why would you ask?
Well,
that?
Well, because it's low density. It's not such a high density place, you know. It's mainly low buildings, you know.
True.
So residential, although there is some residential.
Yeah, and I've been coming here probably for the last 12 months or so. And just in that short period, I've noticed a whole lot of new
it's crazy, right?
Migrants, or I don't know if you want to call them hipsters or whatever, but a lot of people moving in, and they're just when I was coming here 12 months ago, I got bored after like a week, because there isn't that much to do. And I love Roberta's, but the price point is a little bit high, I think.
What is your price point going to be?
There's probably not going to be anything over $10. Yeah.
And does that work out with your rent and stuff? I mean,
The rent is pretty low.
Perfect.
Unfortunately, right now, I mean, we're going to open the restaurant in phases. We have two spaces. One's actually an apartment right now, so I'm kind of subletting that on a vacation rental basis, which pays for the whole space. We have a really nice back garden as well, which is probably going to help us generate.
Although, in defense of Roberta's, I'll say I think a margarita is still like $9 or something.
No, I'm not attacking. I'm definitely not attacking Roberta's.
But there is a void.
I think in this neighborhood, in terms of like good.
That's
good
how I
restaurants.
Felt in London.
Void is the wrong word. But
I have to say right. Having lived here, he's right.
Thank you, Jack.
Yes.
Executive producer of
Nat?
Heritage
the
Radio.
Is that Nat?
Okay, I thought it was
Nat.
I thought it was the boar on the...
It's funny saying, because I felt the same thing when I spent a lot of time in London. I was like, well, do I really want to eat crappy pub food? Or do I want to go to Bibendum Oyster Bar and spend $500? Or do I want to go to Wagamama?
Yeah.
And then like I would always go to the Wagamama for noodles, because it was like the one middle ground. Biggest gripe with London. I couldn't find any middle ground
people
food.
Forget, like, it's really easy to eat badly in those big cities. Like, you're like, oh, I'm going to Paris, I'll be safe. It is so easy to eat bad. It's so hard to eat well, but the places you eat well are great.
London is just so big that you're not going to travel all the way across London just to, you know, grab a small dinner. Whereas in New York,
like $46 by subway.
Yeah,
do you feel you an Americano now, or do you feel allegiance to?
I feel allegiance to New York.
Yes.
Yeah.
To New York City.
But that's still English at heart.
And one last thing, and then we're going to wrap up this interview, and you'll stay in studio with us, and we'll bring everyone in. But this 70s, 80s theme, does that imply decoration of the actual
restaurant? Yeah, decoration, and just vibe. There's a there was a diversity in England during that period where everyone was kind of agitated about everything, and that kind of unified everyone in some weird way. And when I throw parties, I try to bring all kinds of people together. And so I want to, it would be great if I can attract people from the neighborhood that have been here for 20, 30 years, as well as like the newcomers, and just like bring them all together. And maybe some of them will hit it off and others will just hate each other. But
Jason, I'm asking you, favorite 70s, 80s English cultural thing in your life? Thing you think about the most?
Well, I mean, Michael Caine. Definitely.
Yeah,
yeah. My early, like late 70s, early 80s, Michael Caine. I mean,
remember when he did Victory?
Oh,
The World War II Nazi movie with the soccer team. Pele scores.
Yeah, I mean,
goal.
And then so you're talking about Sylvester Stallone is in that movie too.
Yes, he
and walks up. We gotta get out of here, guys. We just won the World Cup, and he like they sneak out. But I would say definitely, Michael Caine. But
I think Michael Caine's been in like 60% of all movies made. All kind of like spy movies, or I mean, he's done very well.
There's that whole like 70s, 80s English kind of spy movie kind of thing. But actually,
there's the Smiths, there's the Clash, you know, there's Pop.
Terrence,
yeah.
The reason this song I played was obviously a Who song, which was from a movie that I love, which is called the. Oh, Jesus Christ, I'm sorry.
Jesus Christ, Superstar?
Jesus Christ.
I think that's the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. That was Francis Lloyd Webber, I think.
Let's skip that. But Chip Shop. Do you know that place, the Chip Shop?
In Brooklyn.
Do you have you been there or anything?
No.
They kind of
fish and chips. I hate it.
Will you guys have any chips on the menu?
So no. It's all electric. We're not actually frying.
So I'm coming in there and I'm like, you know, yo, I just got drunk down the block. I'm having a bangers and mash. Is there anything other on the menu other than that you guys are offering, or is it just?
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll have a couple of staples, English staples, that have low price points. We're going to do a jacket potato. In England, it's typically done with baked beans and cheddar, possibly tuna mayonnaise, which you guys would call tuna salad. We're going to have Plowman's Lunch, which is kind of like our version of a Mediterranean salad. It's like, it's what Plowman would take to the fields.
Slice of cheese, slice of bread.
Yeah, cheese, some cooked ham,
and cocktails.
Pickles.
Cocktails that come up to mind, are you guys going to have on the menu?
Yeah, we're going to do primarily gin. Obviously, we'll have a Pimm's Cup, but we're going to do primarily gin cocktails.
What's a fallback gin for English? I mean, you're going to like beefy. I mean, what is like sort of, if you're really going to be really geeky English, like what would you fall back on?
I don't know.
I'm drinking Plymouth right now, but
Probably Beefeater.
Beefeater.
Hendrix is like a new kid on the block, right?
Yeah,
or
Hendrix.
Feels like it.
Well, it's been around for. Yeah. It's an Empire brand. It's been around for like 15 years, but they promoted the crap out of it.
Yeah, it's just like.
So Jack, you wrote all that down in terms
London.
Of if that menu. Do you like that? We got to keep Jack happy.
I'm definitely with it. It was the American Beauty, I think.
The Limey. It was the Limey.
We're going to have a veggie curry for you,
Steven,
as well, Jack.
Steven Soderbergh directed the Limey.
Free veggie curry for Jack.
Terrence,
you heard it here.
Terrence
Mom, if you're listening.
Awesome, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, we're going to take a break, and
Julian,
then we're going to come
you.
Back.
Thank
and,
you very much for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much, and good luck. And do you have a website, by the way?
Yeah.
At the moment, it's facebook.com/DearBushwick.
And guys,
Dear
follow
Bushwick,
or just check the morning after website, and I will put it up, the opening date on it.
Thank
great.
You.
Cheers,
thank you.
We'll be right back to wrap it up.
That one day we'd be fighting. Hi, this is Moby, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network.
Oh, we got him. Yes.
Oh my God, thanks, Moby, for coming in just to do that.
Yeah.
He had to go.
He had to go.
He says hi, though.
He left. He flew out on his copter. Anyway, we are going to, I guess, take a serious turn. We actually just thought to do this, but in the last kind of 14 minutes of the show, we're going to talk about...
just how the industry, because everyone here was working in New York City during, you know, September 11th, or just in the industry, and how much it changed, and how much it sort of... Downtown restaurants just kind of died, and a lot of restaurateurs, you know, either created avenues for their staff and closed a lot of restaurants and relocated a lot of their staff. So I thought it'd be fun, not fun, but just everybody to kind of to talk about how 10 years later.
Oh, 10 years as of, what are we, how many days are we away? Next week.
Next week. Jim, do you want to maybe start the...
Sure.
I mean, I'm not necessarily getting into like where you are or whatever, but how you think, you know, and I really feel like in a positive way things
I think it has. During the break we were discussing what topic was going to be discussed for this last segment. Patrick asked if it was like, you know, is there a concern about it being too somber? And I think actually in our industry it's got us to really refocus a lot of things. I think primarily in combination with the economy, when crises happen, this ties right into like the hurricane thing and a blackout, or you know, a good alien invasion, which is what this planet really needs, but that's another show, is to really sort of bring people together. And when September 11th happened, it really got to be like, wow, you know, I don't, you know, do I need this langoustine that was, you know, carried by a virgin princess from Gorda? Like, no, I need to sit down with my friends and my family and break bread. And I think that actually decentralized a lot of what was like the restaurant scene in New York was actually the Manhattan restaurant scene, which was actually never truly the case, because I think that there's always been great stuff outside of Manhattan. And now it's really about your local, which is what our restaurant is about. And I think it's definitely what David's restaurant is about. Like,
Dave, where were you? I mean, I know you weren't working at 200 at the time.
No,
I wasn't.
I was in upstate New York. I had just... started college.
Didn't you work at that place? In Ithaca.
There was a restaurant upstate in Geneva called Jelly Beans. I was there for 2 years. That was a music spot, but I hadn't even started there at the time.
After like September 11th in Brooklyn in general too? I think Brooklyn actually benefited a lot from it, because a lot of people weren't venturing into the city. Everything is sort of like kind of canceled itself out at this point, but.
Right. Well, I think like everybody's been saying, and you know, in times of crisis and all that, you know, it's important for people to be able to get together.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting opposite effect, the pleasure effect that gets kind of pushed, you know, to enjoy life, you know, not take things for granted, you know, and that involves the restaurant scene. I mean, here more than anywhere else in the world. I mean, New York City's got the best restaurants.
Period.
It's a real part of the everyday life of people more and more. Do you ladies want to say something about that? I mean, you can feel free to chime in. I know you guys are both involved, but I mean, anyone is welcome to talk about this.
We can't see you.
I mean, everyone lost a good friend. I lost a good friend. His name was Joseph Visciano. But I feel like a lot of what I realized a lot, like myself and David were down in New Orleans after Katrina helping out. And just like in September 11th, a lot of restaurateurs, a guy I worked for a really long time, Drew Neporn, relocated a lot of his people from a restaurant called Layla, which was, it couldn't stay open. I mean, it was a really high concept kind of a place. And he moved a lot of people to Tribeca Grill or Nobu's. And the whole entire downtown area, I would say specifically Chambers Street, not that that was a dining mecca, but a lot of places were lunch places down in there, and they all sort of closed within a few weeks. But I would say a lot of really big restaurateurs that you might not take serious or laugh at stepped up and did a lot of extra things to help out and donated a lot of food and gave, you know, continued people's jobs. So that's one thing I do remember. I mean, you know, we're always affected by it, and I always think about it, and it's always like sort of in the back of a lot of New Yorkers' heads, especially when that earthquake happened. Everybody was like, oh, what the hell? I was in a building and somebody was like, did you feel the building shake? I was like, see ya, bye, I'm going down the stairs. I was like, in 2 seconds, I had a meeting. But that's what I think. It was just a lot of people that never, that have big opinions, restaurants with big opinions, stepped up completely with their staff. Patrick, what was
your story? I guess all I wanted to say about this is, where I was, I was just in my house. I worked out of my house at the time. But I guess my only contribution to this, and then we'll pass it on, yeah. So a couple of people haven't talked. But I just think, I hear what the Republicans are doing, wanting to balance the budget. I mean, I respect that general concept. But I will say that any plan that does not include protecting the people who are the first responders and, protecting people who are suffering still to this day, post-traumatic syndrome, stress syndrome.
They extended the area to Canal Street, too.
Right? Yeah, I mean, any party that cannot answer how they're going to take care of those people, too, that's not a serious party. It's not a serious plan. Those people have to be part of any plan because we can't forget that quickly. And basically, somehow, in Washington, D.C., these people have been forgotten, and programs are being cut for them. I mean, I find that absolutely, as a born and raised New Yorker, outrageous.
Especially because, the first mandate of any elected official should be to protect the people in any capacity, whether the Chinese are invading or, something post-traumatic.
If those guys run into that building first, then you have to take care of them 50 years later.
NYPD, FDNY, and also all
Port
the
Authority.
Other Port Authority, Port Authority, any anyone else, Johnny?
Yeah, the Republicans.
It's funny.
Everyone forgot about it. It's kind of funny how you're saying that because. They're like the first guys to kind of exploit. Oh, the heroes. Oh, we need all these photo ops.
I mean, we did have a Republican mayor at the time, Rudy Giuliani, who did a really good time. But we're talking about
Oh, yeah, that guy.
Where's he been to protect these guys?
100%. I mean, he's...
I don't know. Maybe he has been, but...
I don't know. Last time I saw him, he was at the RNC convention throwing red meat to the delegates. But,
yeah.
But, I mean, well, besides that, let's talk about
your, September 11th memories.
Actually, Jim, we all kind of.
Jim has roots. You guys have roots.
Yeah. We went down there. They said that. I remember that right after September 11th, they said that weren't taking volunteers. And there was no way to get in the area, and
we're like fighting to get.
It was like there was a way to get in, and for us, it was just like, actually, we came through different routes. I was helping through the Salvation Army and talking about these people you never think about. Sullivan Street Bread gave every day. It was like we went down with like three loads of fresh bread down there, and really there was so much coming in that you couldn't even coordinate. I mean, I was on the corner of the Millennium Hotel, and there were doctors standing around that didn't know what to do, and there's like boxes of eyewash and just sort of like setting up things like that and trying to coordinate some of the catering. I was like, there's a lot of sandwiches here, and the Red Bull truck was coming and just sort of, it was just people just dropping it off and being escorted off the premises.
Yeah.
But we were just there because I don't know what else to do.
Yeah, what else to do. Also, I mean, we couldn't open our businesses. So, what you normally do, you can't do. And
Were you guys operating at the
time? I owned Idlewild. I owned an airplane-themed bar on September 11th. So I felt so lucky.
We need a sound effect for that.
Yeah. I stood outside, actually, for weeks afterward, freaking out. And I was like, it's a bus! Come to the train bar. But strangely,
It was a train station.
Unbelievably, like... we did eventually change it to what it is now, which is White Rabbit. But unbelievably, not only did people come back, people were like, hey, I'm not getting on a real plane anytime soon. An amazing amount of people who worked in the airline industry would come because they were just to remember this romantic idea that they were drawn to begin with airline travel. I'm the guy with the airplane themed bar.
Julian?
Any?
I'd only just been in the country for like a year, and I was a headhunter. That was when I was headhunting, terrorist headhunting.
No, but a lot of people that you were probably going for like Wall Street sort of jobs, right?
I didn't actually know anyone that passed away that day, but I mean that for me, that was just that was when I decided to get out of
the whole
office world. Yeah, I. It was a very interesting time.
It's funny you say that. I think like the French Culinary Institute, Institute of Culinary Education, they all did very, very well in those first few years after. I think it really made people reprioritize.
I mean, you see them coming in the kitchen. I mean, whether they come from CIA or French Culinary, there's a lot of people that, I mean, maybe it was because of that or other stuff, but a lot of people have, you know, changed careers or the financial crisis and stuff. But I just, you know, other than that, I'd like to thank everyone for contributing on the high and somber notes of today. But no, I think it's a big part of New York, and it shows a lot about New Yorkers. It was of September 11th, the hurricane or whatever it is, how we kind of sort of come up over these tragedies. David Deal, our first guest from 205th, thanks a lot. Johnny Santiago and Jim Chu of Joe's Restaurant on Elizabeth Street, and Pancake Eating Contest tomorrow at 4. Please come there and support the Pancake Eating Contest and Joe's.
See Jason in person. He'll be signing autographs.
Yeah, that's right. Your ringer is not getting a pass.
Julian Muhammad from Dear Bushwick. I'm Jason Colucci, co-hosting here at Patrick Martin's. Please listen to The Morning After the 18th of September.
Okay.
This is a message from Fork and Anchor. Aaron Fitzpatrick, the host of our wine program, Unfiltered, is looking for help on Kickstarter to open Fork and Anchor, a general store inspired by two food-loving ladies with an equal affection for urban life, the sea, and the agricultural paradise of Long Island's North Fork. The store is situated in a growing community of farmers and winemakers and will become a meeting place offering prepared foods, a variety of sun-dries, and a selection of homespun products, many of which will have their origins in New York State. Your backing will help them fulfill their dream of fostering relationships with the community and making the local food system accessible on a broader scale. Search Kickstarter.com for Fork and Anchor and donate today. The following is a message from NOFA NY. Do you dig local food? Love organic farmers? Do you crave to be part of a growing movement of consumers concerned with the state of our nation's food system? Then sign up today to take the NOFA NY's Locavore Challenge this September. Join 5,000 other New York locavores that are hungry, active, and ready to change our food system. Learn more at www.nylocavorechallenge.com.